Hello and welcome to Phoenix Vision. I'm Jess Farmer and I'm really happy to introduce my guest for today, Ed Thompson. Ed is a holistic health practitioner who helps people solve their challenges with pain, whether that be physical, mental, emotional, or spiritual. We went very, very deep on this podcast and we explored a concept called the six feminine rivers that exist within the human psyche, as well as the different feminine aspects of the male psyche, as well as we looked into the importance of going within, and also spoke a little bit about permaculture, which is a topic that Ed is very knowledgeable in, has practiced for a long time, and is very, very passionate about. So if you're ready to go deep, let's go swimming. Hope you enjoy. Hello and welcome to Phoenix Vision. I am here with my brother, Ed Thompson. How you doing, Ed? You well, mate?
Yeah, Jess, I'm well. It's good to be here with you. Yeah, man.
Right, same, mate, same. So just give you a little intro. Ed is a holistic lifestyle coach and works with people to help solve their health and pain challenges. We met on an amazing mentorship program led by Warren Williams that we're actually coming out of quite soon. It's been freaking great to be on that journey with you, mate. And yeah, Ed is an all-round awesome guy and perfect companion for having a deep conversation about life with. So I hope we're going to go to some depths today, I imagine, and yeah, have a good time. So yeah, I'd just like to kick off, mate, and just like to hear like a little bit about your story. So can you give a rundown of your journey into healing? What led you into working with others, as well as like general life journey to this point thus far?
Oh, nice. Thanks for the intro, Jess. So yeah, I suppose my interest in this kind of healing journey started I can't really pinpoint it, to be honest, except for I started reading Eckhart Tolle. I think it was when I was in the library at college and we had this really enthusiastic librarian, and he had got this The Power of Now book on a stand out, and he was like promoting it to people. And I was like, this guy's actually quite a cool guy. He's been in the gym. He looks quite ripped, and like he's sociable. He's confident in himself. And I think at that point, I was looking for those aspects in myself. So I went with it, and I read this book, and I was just like, man, there's something in this that's just profound, and I don't quite know what it is. But I ended up listening to it on car journeys to training, and just listening to it before bed, and finding that whenever something challenging was happening in relationships at an early age, like with in intimate relationships with girlfriends and that, which I found quite difficult, like I always felt quite shy and insecure and all of those kind of things. So I kind of had this self-awareness of my challenges at quite an early age and the desire to change them, but not necessarily the knowledge of how to. So I think that's kind of my beginning of my story. And I got into athletics. And again, a friend recommended Elliot Hulse and his like philosophy, strongman approach. And in one of his videos, you mentioned Paul Cech's as his mentor. And as soon as I heard that, like I can still picture, if I close my eyes, like the moment on the YouTube video when he was talking about it. And I just like, I've got to check this guy out. And then it was the same level of like being hit with a level of like insight that was, I could tell this person was so much more deep than I'd ever heard any of my teachers talking. He could interconnect things in life. Like his way of thinking holistically was, I tuned in with it, and in reflection now, I feel like learning. I didn't go to a Steiner school or anything like that, but I'm aware that they try and promote left brain, the creative brain. They don't want the left brain to come in until at least age 7. So for me, I had an upbringing where I didn't go to school until I was 11. So my right brain and my left brain didn't really kick in until I was about 11. So I think my holistic creative side is quite strong. And so when I heard Paul Cech talking about things in this holistic nature, it was like I'd forgotten that people like that even existed, because I just stepped into the school system and like gone with it and just started to develop that left side of myself, the rational side. So I kind of cracked open that door and just started to apply stuff in athletics. And that kind of unwound into studying physio, doing the HLC1 course beforehand, holistic lifestyle, getting into sports massage, getting onto a personal training course, and then getting a job in working with chiropractors, and then with like a gym in London, Virgin Active. But then before, like just as I'd started coming into that kind of rhythm and the structure and the stability of my career, like another wave came and my dad passed away, and something in me shifted. It was almost like my emotional mental state was different, and I just decided to drop the career and to go traveling. And so I went on more of a like the hippie route and went to Koh Phangan in Thailand, experimented with plant medicines, and then I journeyed on to Australia and then to New Zealand. And in New Zealand, I got to the point where in Australia, I was working as a labourer, like waking up for work, waking up at 5 a.m., going to work at 7, working a really hard day, like lifting bricks and mortar, getting really strong. And then something, I decided I needed to change it. And I was doing Qigong in the morning and doing yoga and sort of feeling quite settled in my self in knowing what I wanted, because I knew I didn't want to do this bricklaying anymore. And I started to dream up what I would want. And I thought, I want to learn about permaculture. I want to be in groups. I want to learn from the best teachers. And so I was scrolling through New Zealand's permaculture courses, and I found one that was nearly 3 months long, and it had like 5-6 tutors that all looked like world-class. I had like a large group of people. And so I was just like, yes, this is the one. And so I went, it was beyond my expectations, and it was a real highlight of my trip. And so yeah, that's been the most recent. That's been like my most formative series of events. And then I came back in lockdown last year. Or March, at the start of lockdown, the first lockdown, and had a bit of a crisis coming back to the UK from being out of touch with regularity, rhythms, and everything kind of closing in. So I kind of went into another journey, if you like, of becoming aware of my own limitations and my own blockages to just moving forward. And so that's kind of been my journey over the last couple of months, is just raising my awareness of what it is within me that are limits and blockages, and just becoming really sensitive to it, whilst still trying to explore the world and like step outside of that inner reflection mode, exploring permaculture, learning about woodland management, learning about natural building, working with like old ancient Roman building techniques and things like that. And along the way, just meeting real interesting characters, like out there people. And then I went and spent Christmas at a personal development center called Osho Lila, which is like, I think it's based off humanitarianism university in Holland. And they work a lot with Osho's dynamic meditations, and like cathartic release and letting go of repressed emotions that are kind of trapped in the body and stagnant. But basically there was about 30 of us, and we really gelled. A lot of people between the ages of 20 to like 40. And there I had this massive cathartic release, and some like deep aspects of my childhood just came up and out. And it was like a held grieving process that I think tribal cultures do when people die. I'd never had that opportunity to even get in touch with those emotions. So I've been on like my journey's been quite rich and full in many ways, even though it hasn't necessarily been that pleasant along the way. I'm living in Cornwall, and I'm still unwinding from that process and learning to connect with my heart and my feelings, and learn to differentiate between the wounded aspects of myself, where I feel like I've been hurt or victimized, and the parts of myself that can just notice that and then start to generate a more, basically just a more connected to this present moment and the reality that of my skills and my connections and everything, can start to reform a new version of my vision for how I want to be in life. And so, yeah, I'm in this kind of, this formative, a very formative stage of I suppose being a man. And tied into that, I did a vision quest when I came back from New Zealand, which was like a 4-day fast in nature, which was pretty special as well. So that's kind of me up to this moment.
Fantastic, mate. Packed. Like, it's also, I'm always, every time I talk to you, it's like so impressed with your self-astuteness and self-awareness and the insights that you have, and this is, sounds like a beautiful journey so far. And I love it that you started with the power of now as well, because actually it's really funny, 2 days ago I was literally talking to one of my clients about power of now, so it's two times here in a week that means something. So maybe I need to go back to that book myself, but that book was actually really formulative and helpful for myself at the start of my journey, and as well. And in many ways, it was the first, I picked that book, or I actually got past that book by a friend, and a time where I was going through like a really difficult time. And reading that book was kind of the thing that was keeping my head above water and just giving me the concept of not being in the mind. And I think one of the most powerful realizations from that book was like the what's watching the thinker, or something like that. What's watching the viewer, or something like that. But it's basically the premise that we're seeing all of these thoughts go through our mind, and there must be something behind those thoughts viewing the thoughts and asking the question, what is that thing? And you start delving into that, and is you can delve into that for a long time. And for me, it was very helpful just to actually create that separation between the thoughts and that something else that's viewing the thoughts. Opens the possibility of that we're not our thoughts, kind of thing. So yeah, it's a really great book. I really recommend it to anyone. So yeah, let's I'd love to get into a few concepts that we were chatting about a while ago. So I was fascinated when I came to visit you about your study in something called the six rivers of the feminine that exist within the psyche. I'd love to unpack it a little bit. Mm-hmm. So my question is, what are the six feminine rivers? And how do they relate within the masculine and feminine psyches? Then how can we use the concept of the rivers to direct our actions and behavior towards healing and growth? So since it's quite a deep concept as well, would you first be able to give like a bit of a general preface to the masculine and feminine energies so that listeners kind of have something to anchor to? Because a lot of people, when you say masculine and feminine, kind of dart straight towards like, masculine is men and feminine is women, but there's much more to it, and it's not necessarily mutually exclusive to the sexes, because both energies exist within us all. So, yeah, quite a question for you. So,
nice, thanks, Jess. Get my mind ticking. I feel like maybe the best place to start with that is looking at romantic relationship, because I feel like everyone gets that. And to recognize that, like, the culture that we've all come out of, or most of us have come out of, has quite defined roles. So like the woman, in the way I was brought up, my mum looked after me, she cooked the meals, she made sure that like the home environment was one that was safe and nurturing. And then my dad would be the guy that brings the money back and would show up, would wake up every day and go to work and do his job. And so like on that level, that's kind of the masculine and the feminine on a external perspective, because I feel that's the easy place to start, is to go to our projections and to see, you know, the feminine is this nurturing quality, the one that's kind of accepting of life. A bit like archetypally, you might go out in nature and you can do anything to like nature. Like it will just take whatever you do. Like you can chop down a tree, it's not gonna punch you in the face like if you try and chop it down, you know. It provides food and it's like the sunshine, the warmth, and all the free energy, if you like, that is abundant in nature. I feel like you could look at that as the feminine within us. It's kind of like a source of energy and inspiration. Like artists get a lot of inspiration from the things that they see beauty in around them. So that's the feminine, the way I perceive it. And then the masculine is like the masculine is like, for me, the strongest version of it is the mind. And like my dad was an engineer and like a mechanical engineer, and was very good at like taking things apart and then putting them back together. So my kind of experience of that is my mind's ability to see everything as separate, or to like learn biology in school. I used to love seeing all the separate components of a cell and go, oh, the mitochondria does this, the cell membrane does that, the nucleus does that, and then within that, and then da da da, and it takes us all the way down to an atom, and you know, very, you know, physics, and then we go to quantum physics. It's kind of the way of taking something and cutting it up until we can't cut it up anymore. So like coming back to the romantic love concept, where you've got the masculine and feminine energies at play within a relationship, usually it's like flipped. It's like love-hate relationships. It's like deeply in love, but then it kind of flips to arguments and disagreements. And I feel like the concepts of the six rivers of the feminine are, yeah, it's quite deep. And maybe I've only come across it about quite a few months ago, but I've really been inspired by it. And the first one, I'm just going to pull it out of my mind. The first one is, I'm not going to give them first ones, but there's an archetypal feminine, which is Mother Earth as a sort of example. And then you've got Sophia, or wisdom, which is learning, and yeah, like philosophy is a study of Sophia. It's like study of wisdom. So Sophia is a word for wisdom in Latin, I think, or there's some kind of roots there. And then we've got a term which is a few terms. It's like the fair maiden, which is kind of more like mythology based. And then Carl Jung called it the anima in men and animus in women. And that's like the inner feminine, it's like the soulmate within yourself, which we'll have to go deeper into that to explain what that means. But then there's the mother complex, which is the mother complex within a guy is like the wanting to fail so that we can go back to having our child needs met. So it's this kind of inner desire to be a loser, basically, because if we're a loser, at least we'll get the love for being hurt. It's like when you hurt your knee, you get given love and you know, you're a legitimate victim, you've hurt your knee, you get bandages and that. But sometimes we can fall into that complex and walk around as a victim so that we can get love through that kind of that avenue that is is widely accepted by everyone. You know, if you're not feeling good, if you say, oh, I'm feeling depressed or I'm feeling like unhappy or whatever, people give you sympathy or empathy. And so you kind of feel connected. So it's not necessarily right or wrong. It's just it is what it is. And then the last one is the actual mother, the mother that raised us, the physical person. So our relationship to our mother as a person. So, yeah, so those are the six rivers. You'll have to prompt me again now where we're going.
yeah, there's so much to unpack within every single point there. I think where maybe it's good to start is the kind of explanation of like the anima and the animus, because I think it's especially important whereby, you know, a lot of men deny the feminine qualities within themselves. So, you know, sometimes like even the very suggestion that there may be a feminine part of the masculine, like that might actually trigger a few men and be, oh no, there's no feminine within me, what are you chatting about, I'm all man kind of thing. But like, there is that feminine part within every single man, as is there's that masculine part in every single woman. And this is, if you were to look at this like symbol of the Tai Chi symbol of the yin yang, this is what the within the blackness of the yin, there's the spot of the white, indicating the masculine, the small bit of masculine within the feminine. And within the white of the yang, the masculine principle, there's the small dot of the yin. So yeah, it'd be great for like to unpack like the anima and animus, and also from specifically from the masculine perspective, because I think there's a lot of denial of the feminine within men, but also within our culture and society, which is part of the reason, some say would be the main reason why we're in such a mess with the planet, because there's such a strong neglect of the feminine, which is can be seen in us neglecting nature, destroying nature, as well as what's happening societally as well.
and I feel like the reflection from a masculine perspective, like that's the journey I'm looking at the moment. And as I understand it from reading a bit of Robert A. Johnson's work on the masculine, it's quite a different process, and it is probably maybe not as well documented or researched, the feminine perspective. But and the contamination, the aspect of contamination between the layers of those rivers, where when one river combines with another, so like when the mother complex gets tied in with your actual mother, if those two rivers meet and dirty one another, that's when issues really arise, or if any of the rivers contaminate. So if we're not able to distinguish and discern the difference between the love that nature gives us through food, like when we eat stuff, like it's been grown from the soil and we're consuming it. If we confuse that with the mother complex, you know, it might manifest as we're projecting our need to fail onto the earth, but we can do onto the earth and our relationship to the earth. But the trouble is to understand this stuff is quite difficult on a level where we actually feel it as a known sensation, because it's quite unconscious. Mm. So the anima within the man is like connecting to our soul, which is our feelings, which is also like knowing our values and knowing what we care about. So maybe that's an easy place for guys to connect to it from, because like when you see something is happening and you know that it's not right, like you see someone at school being bullied and you see them, you know, getting slapped in the face, pushed around, and they're weaker than the other guys, you go, well, this ain't right, you know, what's going on here? Now, there's a part of you that rises up and goes, no, not any more of this. And so that quality of knowing what's right and wrong and having a feeling sensation, a strong value, and protecting that value, that is the yin yang. That's like the masculine rising to protect the feminine. And that quality of the feminine is felt within yourself. You know, when you perceive something and you see something, like you see a beautiful woman on the street, it's you who's looking at that woman, and it's you who are feeling those feelings of attraction. So you're only ever able to, you're only able to appreciate a woman because you have that, you have somewhere within yourself, the awareness and the recognition of what it is. Like you can see a beautiful woman, and then within yourself, you feel what it, you have certain feelings or emotions or energy arise. They stimulate you with inside. And they can only do that if it's actually present in you. You know, if you had no idea what if you were totally masculine and there was no such thing as feminine, you know, it's kind of, it just doesn't work. It doesn't make any sense. So, but what can happen is that the conscious mind can repress any feminine, like, feminineness within oneself, and just be very clear and very kind of like closed-minded and very just going one way, very linear. And the question of that is, well, why? You know, like, why are you doing that? Like, why are you deciding that you just want to build the biggest tower? Why are you deciding you just want to make the most amount of money? Why are you deciding that you just want to pack on the most amount of muscle? You know, what is the energy behind it that's driving it? And so that's the first place you can connect to. If you feel really disconnected to your feminine nature, you know, it's always there within you behind everything that you're doing. You can't actually separate it out. It's like, you can't actually separate out yin and yang. It's like that seed within the white, that black seed within the white is there present within it. You can't take it out. So the difficulty starts arising because we are at a point in time, I feel like, where if you like, maybe DNA is a good example, like we carry DNA, right? Like from times past, like we carry this, like when plants grow and then they reproduce, that new seed carries the genetic imprint from the last generation. And so we're carrying all these imprints from so many generations, and within all of those generations and those imprints, there's a lot of buildup of things that didn't get spoken about. You know, like bad things happen. Like I've been learning about some of my family history recently, and I'm like, well, I never even knew that. You know, why was my dad had tendencies towards alcoholism? Why did his mum? Why did his dad? Oh, it's because his wife died in pregnancy at childbirth, and there was no resolution. There was no integration after that experience. He just kind of shut it down, closed it off. And so he was closing off his own feelings. He was closing off his own ability to connect to his sense of what is right and wrong. And he started to blame himself for what had happened, which, you know, is kind of like a masculine tendency is to want to fix everything and also want to blame themselves if something doesn't go quite right. And so if the woman that he's in a relationship with is unhappy, he kind of has this tendency to want to fix it or change her or change the situation so that she feels okay. But that in its compulsive nature is like non-acceptance of the woman. It's like not accepting her for who she is and what she's feeling. And that, when someone's not accepting you for who you are, is repulsive. So to me, that's like toxic masculinity, which isn't about being like this big guy who's like really strong necessarily. Toxic masculinity, I think, is just like, it's just a product of trauma, basically, that where something's painful that's happened in a man's life or in as a man through a man's lens of perspective on it, and blames himself and shames himself and hasn't got other guys, other people in the community, like a tribe of guys that can witness what's happened, and he can relax and go, it's okay, even though a load of shit happened, people died, you know, people blame me for this and that, they can relax and know that they're still held and safe and accepted by the tribe. But as we've stepped out of that tribal culture and community culture and been more sort of separated out and only very superficial on a sort of community level, we're not really looking at the deeper stuff, then, I mean, yeah, that's where we're at the moment. Like that's maybe why where I'm coming to with this, looking at the feminine within us, because it's not that we're saying that I'm now a woman, or if I accept that I've got a feminine nature, it's not saying I'm a woman. It's saying I have a relationship to women. I have a relationship to the feminine within women, and my relationship to other women and their feminine nature, it's my relationship to them. So if I'm carrying some beliefs and some ideas that are not working, they're creating painful situations, that's going to be the best mirror to know, like, to make this topic relevant, you know. So if there's difficult communications with your mum, with your sister, with your wife, your girlfriend, your partner, whoever it is, your grandma, you just difficult in socializing with women, meeting, dating, any of that, they're reflecting back to you things that are within yourself. So it's like, rather than trying to fix it on the outside and change the person or be overly controlling and be this kind of irritating person that can't relax, you can start to build a practice of looking inside at what it is that's creating the issue, and then using life as a mirror rather than, you know, attacking the mirror. So yeah, I mean, I think I'll leave it there with that.
Yeah, no, there's so much in there. I mean, yeah, it's such a good, I find, useful way of moving through life, or an essential way of moving life through life, is knowing that you have this constant barometer around you at all times, this constant mirror. And, you know, everything happening within our life, within our relationships, if we can recognize that, okay, if it is creating pain, this is some area of ourselves that isn't healed or needs to be looked at, this could be a really powerful way of moving through life, because life is constantly teaching you, and it's difficult at times, maybe a lot of the time. But I find that if you can look at it in terms of this mirror perspective, then you can move through things a lot quicker. And you know, it could be pain anywhere. It's not necessarily just within the relationships, but if there's something happening within the business, it's like, right, okay, where's that within me and what needs to be resolved? And I think it's quite interesting what was coming up when you were talking about the ways in which men and women relate to emotions and emotional challenges. So like men tend to, not all men, but tend to close down, generally speaking, whereas women tend more so than men to open up when there are emotional challenges, and tend to share and speak with other people. And as a result, women can generally process emotions and are said to be on average more emotionally intelligent than men. Then you look at the male suicide rates, is one of the biggest killers. I think it might be the biggest killer of men in our country. And I'm not sure about the rest of the world, but it's going to be a big player. And I think it's quite interesting that men kind of, again, not all men, but the tendency to close down. And do you think that this tendency to close down is in a way a denial of the feminine, because it's a denial of the feelings?
Yeah, it's a good question. I like that. Like that closing down feeling, the way that it's coming through me is when you feel like you're not capable of fixing the problem. And so therefore your very essence of being a man, that's being of service, that can produce, that can make things happen, that can make things move, the validation that I'm a man and I'm worthy to be here. If you're faced with a problem that's way bigger than you, that you're never going to accomplish, and your sense of self starts getting tied into that issue, and it's just always there in front of you wherever you go, suddenly you just start feeling worthless as a man, and that you're not, your purpose is no longer being fulfilled. And so you might as well not be here because you're not doing anything. You're just a waste of space. You just, you know, you're just consuming, and that there's that maybe a hypersensitivity to that, and also quite a narrow focus on that. And it's an overwhelming sensation. Now I feel like the magic in that's present in there that I've found is that it is possible to fix, but not in the way we've been looking at it. Like, we can fix it, and it's, but the problem is it's not what it looks like. It's not the outside world that needs fixing. It's not the relationships that we see in our life that need fixing. It's not the way we are at work. It's not the way we are with our family or our friends. Those things don't need changing. It's like little things. Like I had a dream the other day that came up, and I realized I had a lot of resentment towards my siblings, my brothers, and I was holding this anger inside towards them from an early age. And I can start to connect dots, and I can see, oh yeah, I was really like carrying a lot of frustration towards them, but I had to suppress it. I had to keep that anger down in order just for life to feel like smooth and like a happy childhood, you know? So already at that age, at a young age, like somehow this processing power that I had was able to go, I fucking don't want to be around you guys. You guys really, oh wait, I can't not be around you because you're my family, you nourish me. So I have to just keep these emotions down a bit in order to let life move on. But when my family hasn't got much emotional intelligence either and cannot see what I'm doing to myself because they were doing it to themselves unconsciously. So no one's there to then help me let go of that resentment tomorrow or the next day or next week. My brothers aren't going to go, oh, Ed, you know, you look like you're a bit pent up full of anger. What are you doing? It unplays unconsciously. We fight, you know, we kick and punch, and we let the anger out in other ways. But like somatically letting it go, but the belief may not have been released. The mental belief that we can somatically release, but if the belief hasn't been addressed, because, you know, we didn't have anyone in our culture to help us work through the belief that was formed about not being good enough because I couldn't express myself around my brothers, because my brothers didn't think that I was good enough. All, you know, all of these kind of little things that never get addressed, suddenly they build up. You know, like in school, I'm not good looking enough. My penis isn't big enough. My, you know, I'm not confident enough. I'm not, and so they kind of and then they kind of go on this downward spiral where they feed each other, because once you start having a few of them, and then you're not quite confident, and then the social circle suggests that if you're not confident, then you continue being not confident, and you keep spiraling down. So any opportunity in life where it's like, right, now it's time to stand up and be a man, and, you know, what you've got inside is you're full of shit. So you can't do anything, you know? You go to rise up one day, you're like, I'm going to change my life today and be like a man and like man up. But inside, you're carrying all of these wounds and all of this, like, limiting ideas about yourself that were formed at such an early age, and you had no one to support you in letting go of that stuff. So like my journey with that is you know, realizing that it is possible to let go of those things and to build relationships with people who are also letting go of this stuff, and learning to realize that that's the stuff that needs fixing, and that we don't have to shrink away from that, because we're in control of it. That's legitimate control. We have a sense of legitimate control in our lives because we're working with ourselves. And so So we don't have to shrink away from it. We don't run away from it. We don't have to run away from ourselves. We can't run away from ourselves. It's just ourselves running away from ourselves. You know, there's no such thing really. So that's where freedom is, you know, like that's what I think. So if we're shrinking away from things on the outside, maybe it's happening for a reason so that we can turn to ourselves and unpack what is in within with help.
Absolutely, mate. I think very statement, be a man, is so loaded, right? Yeah, with everything you just said about, you know, unpacking things, doing the work, looking inside, this to me is what it means to be a man and move into being a fuller man. But that very statement, be a man, is so loaded because potentially toxic because of the application from unhealed men a lot of the time. To say like, man up, be a man, boys don't cry, like, you know, and it's almost as though when used in that context, that more negative context, is like, deny the fact, be a man by denying the feminine, right? And this is how that is like almost like given across and portrayed, and often through men with like feminine wounds. So from the balance perspective of being a man, what does that mean to you?
Yeah, well, I love that. I love that you brought that up because I feel like it contains a gold, you know, like if something's loaded, if something's energized, if something triggers you, then you don't have to look any further. So it be a man, I suppose it's like the, yeah, oh, my mind's gone blank, but be a man, say it again, man. It's like being the wounded feminine and the contamination of those feminine rivers that we spoke about right in the beginning. That is be a man is about differentiating between a negative mood and a value. So be a man means you, sir, are not ruled by negative moods. You have a choice to choose values and authentic feelings over negativity. And when we can learn to be a man, it means to be able to differentiate within ourselves which one we're acting out. And if you see a man that's like, I'm being a man, but he's still in a mood, it's like, no, you're not being a man. You're just being in a mood. And like, you're just moody. Like, yeah, that's what you're doing. But when you meet a guy that's like, he's making choices in moment, day to day, week to week, based on, as best as he can, the values. And those are like caring about life, caring about other people, caring about yourself, your health, your happiness. You're making decisions about your career based on your happiness and based on other people's happiness, based on your health and based on the effect on other people's health that you love. Then when you can make the choices as best you can in that way, aware of yourself and aware of your relationships versus, oh, I'm having to go to work because I have to do it like this. And, you know, I've witnessed that so much, man. And that is not being a man. That's being a woman. that's being identified with the moody inner woman within a man. I'm not talking about moody woman on the outside. I'm talking about being a moody woman on the inside. The thing is that where that leads to, it's probably as a little boy, you probably had to deal with some adult energies that were very childish and immature, and so that's what you picked up on. So it's no blame game, it's just awareness.
Yeah, that's so powerful, mate. Very powerful way of putting things. So just to clarify, when you say in sort of like moody woman, that might be like women listening to this might be like, what? But it's not meant in that perspective, is it? It's a different it's like a different personification.
Yeah, that's when I say that, I'm just saying it so it's like relatable. It's like a projection onto women, like guys who say, oh, you're a moody you're moody, you're a cow, you're this, you're that. That's a projection, but we deal with that in the world so often that I think everyone gets it. But what I'm really referring to is the inner feminine of a man. When a woman sees that a guy starts feeling sorry for themselves and acting out from that place, they're caught up in their own inner feminine mood, which is very different to a woman. A woman is a person, but a man that's caught in their own inner feminine negativity, self-negative, that's then the feminine is a negative charge. It's kind of like a, but it contains that when a man learns to relate to that inner negativity and hear the message that's really in it, then it can turn into what would be passion and purpose and values and drive. So there's no good, that everything contains like light and dark. Everything's got two sides to it. So it's definitely not about labeling women as good or bad. It's seeing the feminine quality as having two sides to it.
And then for my understanding, to loop back to the earlier mother complex, what you're describing there about like the inner negative traits of the feminine mood, would that be the unhealed mother complex, which then really relates to the victim and the child archetypes?
That energizes the, it's like not the same thing, but the mother complex is, I suppose, a collective, a term for describing the collective an experience of lots of individuals of being a wounded child and of being a victim child, someone that's innocent, that is subject to whatever might happen. You know, you're reliant on someone else to protect you, on someone else to feed you. You're experiencing what a victim is, but you're not necessarily labeling it as like that's who, you shouldn't be a victim, or you shouldn't, you know, it's not about that. I think it's more about that witness state of consciousness where you're able to go, oh yeah, I was a victim as a child, that's part of being part of life. But to stay stuck in that, to stay stuck in that level of consciousness where you're walking around life always feeling and thinking and believing and just in an automatic mode, you're energizing that, and that's then the mother complex is like a collective term to describe, it's like a blueprint, it's like, you know, thousands of people are all experiencing that and they're feeding into what would be the mother complex.
Gotcha. Oh, mate, this is something I could happily chat about like freaking all day. We covered a lot of ground there. I mean, there's still so much more to unpack with it. I got a few other topics I'd like love to go through, but yeah, it's really powerful stuff, man. Thank you for that. Next question is, there's a yogic saying of go within or go without. So I'd love to explore what this saying brings up in you, as well as what the importance of inner work and living with presence is to you. What does it bring to your life, and how does it help you in your growth and development?
We've touched that a little bit already with the feminine work, but to go within it's a myth comes up that I read a few days ago that's about I think it comes from like Hansel, and it's like a medieval kind of myths, and it's a boy that goes to this big oak tree and finds a bottle and he uncorks it, and it's like really angry spirit comes out and it's like, say, I'm going to chop your head off. But the boy is like pretty quick on his feet, and he's like convinces him to get back in the bottle, and then he bottles him up, and the spirit in there is like, oh, please let me out, I'll give you whatever you want, blah blah blah. And eventually he lets him out, and he does. He gives him like a golden axe or something. But generally what I'm saying is that that's a description of going within, because within it is like opening up a bottle. We haven't been in there for a long time, and things can get stagnant and things can get pissed off and angry. And so I'm starting the conversation maybe on the dark side of it, because for this is my experience, to start going within, it can be a nice experience, but it can also come to meet parts of yourself which haven't been looked at and are angry and potentially dangerous to engage with on our own, and from the level of thinking that we're approaching it from. So I feel like from my perspective now, if I was to offer myself some advice to when I started doing the inner work, like when I was listening to Eckhart Tolle and even just starting that journey, is to say it's fine to listen to audiobooks, but where are the people in your actual physical life who you're able to have intimate conversations with and are able to be supported and who can see you and are taking care of you as well, and who can be part of your team, if you like a coach, right? So I grew up and I did a lot of athletics and I had coaches. Now, coaches are the one element of athletics that are able to help you improve and to see where you're not seeing yourself. And so if I didn't have coaches to watch me and to say, oh, Ed, on that jump, you know, you didn't quite do this, or you could da 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 da. And there's a relationship, there's a flow of energy, there's trust, there's support. Now, the issue is that doing the inner work in a culture where there's not really the appreciation of what that even means, you can be doing your inner work and going to athletics and be supported through, oh, you're sleeping okay, yeah, you're eating okay, or da da da. But then as soon as someone stops eating okay and they stop sleeping so well, or they stop showing up to training, people think it's like a biological issue. They think it's like a mechanical issue. And all they want to do is give you some drugs. Like, I had a foot pain. Oh, just take an anti-inflammatory. You know, don't bother even looking at the posture. And what does the posture represent? The posture is a mental emotional state. If you're constantly slumped over, looking down at the ground, and you're bent over and whatnot, that's a reflection of what's going on inside of you. So the inner work is like half of life. It's like the amount of time you spend dreaming and sleeping, or daydreaming, or like not really thinking, you know, not really engaged. Like, all of that time is like inner work. We're doing it all the time already. I think we're doing it. We're doing it. We're just not aware of what we're doing, and we're not harnessing the power that's really there. We're kind of just using it as relief. It's like the metaphor would be like the growing up and having the urge to experience sort of an orgasmic sort of relief sensation, but the education is just pornography on the internet. But when you open up a book like Mantak Chaya's book on multi-orgasmic man, you realize there's like thousands of years of knowledge that this same impulse can take you to places that you never ever unlock unless you had someone guiding you through it with this ancient wisdom. And so what I suppose is I'm really saying is, rather than thinking like, I think like tendency for the mental mind to go, well, I need to find inner work. I need to find out about inner work and look for it. But it's happening all the time. But to have guidance and to have a knowledge structure that's legitimate So you go to like Eastern arts, you go to India, you go to sort of some culture that has it as an integral part of its, you know, religion. Religion is like inner work. You know, you're looking at yourself, you're looking at values and all this kind of thing. And so some sort of structure, some sort of organization, some sort of ancient teaching, something that's got a community aspect to it that you can learn about yourself without losing yourself. Because I feel like that when people try and do it on their own or they do it alone, you've got so many blind spots that you might just end up, you know, going and taking ayahuasca 100 times and losing your mind, or, you know, just end up living your life hiding all the time. So it's kind of like, that's my perception of it anyway. Like, I feel like inner work is basically, it's happening all the time. And it's controlling us way more than we ever realize. Inner work is like the unconscious. It's like the tip of the iceberg. You know, everyone knows they've seen that picture of like the little tip of the iceberg and they've got this huge thing at the bottom. Inner work is like that massive boulder of work that really is the powerhouse to our experience of life. And so it's an exploration. Yeah. And it's like, there's preparation, there's knowledge, there's guides, there's so much there, but it's your personal exploration of yourself, of your life, of why things happen in the way that they do, of why you are the way you are. And then just like, yeah, it's like, are you living if you're not doing the inner work?
Yeah, I think the inner work is the path in many ways towards living a happy, full, fulfilled life. And that kind of leads on to the next question, and it's a question about the spiritual warrior. And so how does the inner work, doing the inner work, tie in to the concept of the spiritual warrior or being a spiritual warrior, and what does that concept look like from your perspective?
Yeah, I feel like being a spiritual warrior is being able to live like, so for example, before I knew what a spiritual warrior was, before I had the concept in my mind, I was still acting it out anyway. I was still acting out what it meant to be a warrior. So like the concept of being a warrior is you're unswayed. People, the difference between being a warrior and being someone that can be pulled left, right, and center, who can be shown a magic bag of beans or some shiny gold coins, and they're just like, oh yeah, I'll go and do that. You know, that looks fun. Which is, there's nothing inherently wrong with it. I'm just making a distinction between someone that is on purpose and knows what they're trying to achieve, or at least is guided by their primary focus and their primary drive. And then when things come to you that seemingly want to pull you off mission, like let's say you've got a competition that you're doing at the weekend and you've got a focus, you know, your overarching dream, you want to head in the direction of being a professional athlete, and then you're invited out to party late at night and go for fast food, then being a spiritual warrior is a bit like pruning away aspects of ourselves that we no longer need them in order to achieve our mission, which is kind of painful, which is like having to let go of aspects of ourselves that want certain things. And so, yeah, I think really the word spiritual before the word warrior is just about recognizing that you're not just taking everything at face value. You can see a little bit deeper into things. Like you can see your social circle, they're not particularly empowered in themselves. They feel a bit sorry for themselves. They're going out to drink, not because they want to have a good time, but because they want to kind of drown the feelings out. So if you're a spiritual warrior, it doesn't mean you can't go out and celebrate, you know, and have a really good time. But you'll know the difference between celebrating and being in a state of denial and using substances to kind of cover up moods and things like that. So it's honesty. It's honesty, it's clarity. And yeah, that's my experience of it. I mean, I engaged in a spiritual sort of warrior path quite early on, with deciding to not drink, to not do drugs, to train, to step away from social circles that were kind of quite unhealthy. And I experienced a lot of benefit from it, and made a lot of progress, but it's an ongoing journey. Like, things can happen, you know, that really knock you off path. So I think being a spiritual warrior also is about recognizing it's not so much about the activity that you're choosing to do. It's more about your attitude and your approach to any endeavor or any situation that ever happens. Even if you find yourself lost, like, well, what am I doing now? I've lost my education path. I've lost my career path. I've lost my social circle. I've lost my, my family structure, all of these things. It's like, to be a spiritual warrior in that situation, if your identification of being a warrior is tied to a certain activity that you've had a lot of success in, suddenly drops away, then are you able to shift and bring those learnings of being a spiritual warrior to a new path and a new level where you feel like you're a beginner again? It's like a small fish in a big pond. It's like, can you go from being a small fish in a small pond and then being taken out and chucked into a big pond and still continue on being a warrior, like Finding Nemo, something like that.
Yeah. Sydney. Yeah, mate, that's really beautiful, man. And I think what kind of came up as you were talking is that it's kind of like being a spiritual warrior is doing the right thing, whether that's within your external actions or internal thought processes, doing the right thing to your value system, no matter what. So, you know, take the drinking example, and also it depends on the energy behind why you're doing something. So the drinking example, so it might actually be the right thing at that moment in time, if you want to celebrate and be social, to go and do that. And that is the right thing at that moment that goes in with your values, if the energy is in the right place. But if it's the other way, then actually that's going to go against your values. So if you were to do that, you wouldn't be in the place of the warrior, because you'd be deflecting and negating your own value system, which ultimately, you know, leads to your pain. So it's kind of like doing the right thing in the moment, even though sometimes it's difficult. A lot of the time it's difficult, otherwise you wouldn't be the warrior, no matter what. So that's kind of what came up for me there. And what would your thoughts be on that?
Yeah, it's a few things came to mind. Like, I mean, I think everyone knows the marshmallow test, like where the kids that were able to hold off from eating a marshmallow and the instant gratification and the pleasure, later in life they found it a lot easier in life to do the right thing, because they witnessed the benefit of saying no, and then later on something really good happening. And so it's like, if we fill our life up too early and try and get that perfect job, like in London as a banker, like from age 20, and we feel like, yeah, we've done it, yeah, fuck, you know, I've done it, you know, I made it. But you're only 20. You're like, the void's going to just come back again. So it's kind of recognizing, like, it's an addiction cycle. It's like the path of the spiritual warrior is about saying no. It's about ending things. It's about saying no and realizing that when you say no, new things are going to come by themselves. So it's not really about pondering whether I should say yes or not. it's kind of being so relaxed and so okay to say no to things because you trust that better things are on their way. But being in a place where you're not attached to that pattern of saying no either. So it's kind of like when a good opportunity does come up, you are willing, you can just say yes. So it's a balance, but recognizing you've got to say no often a lot more than you say yes. And then that might become like a subconscious process where you're not even consciously having to do it. It's a skill learned now. So I think being a spiritual warrior is also a skill, and we can apply it across our life, like, and not to be too hard on ourselves. And actually, if we were to take full account of ourselves, we might find that we're a spiritual warrior in many aspects of our life already, but in other aspects, we're not. And so it's linking those two things together and going, well, I'm experiencing success in these parts of my life, but I just took it for granted. And then how can I apply that to what's happening now or things that happened in the past? So, and everyone sees, like, I feel like there's certain, so many archetypal images that people get that it just clicks, like the wolf. It's the wolf that you feed grows stronger. And by not feeding the other wolf, it's going to inherently grow weaker and die. And I remember learning in physiology about brain synapses and how things connect. And it's like the only way you stop energizing a brain neural pathway is to just don't engage with it at all. You know, you've got to stop engaging with it. But then what they didn't teach me at that point in time was about the fact you have to become aware of the synapse, that pathway in the first place, in order to disengage from it. Because if it's driven below the conscious mind and it's held in the nervous system in a way where you're not even aware of that negative or that pattern that you want to change, that is aligned with saying yes to things and making you feel like you haven't got control in your life, like being the antithesis of a spiritual warrior, you first of all got to become aware of the areas that you're not being a spiritual warrior in your life and be okay with the fact that you're doing that, and having enough self-esteem to accept all the aspects of yourself which are suck, basically, that you want to change, and then picking ones at priority and stop doing them and be okay with that kind of void and that empty place where nothing's happening, because that's where your imagination can start to come through. But then that's a whole other subject. Like, our imagination, they get shut down as kids, and we're taught, you know, not to use our imagination constructively in that. So I think there's fear in that void space. Mm. And I feel like that's why people don't want to stop.
Yeah, there's also the potential as well, because we, you know, there has to be a void in order for something new to fill it. If we haven't, say, broken down the old patterns and got rid of the things that don't work, how can we build something that works on top of that? It's like trying to build the house on the shaky foundation. So it's like I have to kind of create that sometimes scary void in order to be able to change and, you know, fill it with something more empowering, more aligned to who and what we want to be. Ed, we're getting low on time, mate. I've got more questions for you, man. We didn't even get into like permaculture, which I was kind of thinking that we could possibly even talk about permaculture for an entire episode. So, but quick as one of the last questions, and maybe if you're up for it, maybe we could expand and do another episode more kind of around permaculture. But based on my small knowledge on the topic, I understand it's a very holistic agricultural method of working in harmony with the land to not only grow amazing and beautiful food, but also benefits the local ecosystem that is adopted in. So I'd love to know like a little bit about your experience in permaculture, and just to generally unpack it for any listeners who may be interested in finding out more. And then maybe if it's a big wealth of a topic, maybe we can explore it in depth another time.
Yeah, it sounds good. Yeah, it is a big topic, and you can take it anywhere. So my experience of it really started. I did 6 months in Germany where I visited some small holdings, and the guy had moved out of the city with no prior experience of living as a person working the land, and he'd started growing his own vegetables, looking after his own animals, storing his own firewood, putting up solar panels so that he had his own energy. So a lot of it is about building self-reliancy and self-independence in order to be like self-actualized, so that you've got a sense of I'm contributing something, I'm being creative, I'm a creative person that influences the world around me. I'm co-creating. So when you look at permaculture, you're given this kind of like basic principles. There's 12 basic principles that you look at, and all of them are helping you as guiding ideas as to how you can make something sustain itself. So if you were to think of how much waste we produce as a society, we throw things in the bin and it leaves, permaculture would go, how do we look at this system and say there's no such thing as waste? Because if we've got waste as a concept, we're going to handle waste. And what we've got now is just a big pile of shit floating around that's called waste. So if there's no such thing as waste, we wouldn't have a big pile of shit just floating around. So it's about integrating waste back into the system so that it's not just isolated out and never integrated back into the system. So it's an integrative system. And it's so far reaching. My experience was going to New Zealand. My main one was going to New Zealand and learning from permaculture educators. I had teacher Rabina McCurdy, who learned from, was it either Holmgreen or there's two main kind of Western white guys that kind of started really pushing it as an education for people. And it's a paradigm shift. It's a perspective shift. It's a personal philosophy. It's a way of seeing the world in an integrated way, but also seeing it as isolated from each other, so you can understand its functions, its needs, its outputs, inputs, outputs. So if you got 100 components, like 100 bits of Lego, and each one had a different, like, unique form, each one had a different input output, it's about going, right, how do we put these together so that everyone's feeding each other's inputs and needs and outputs? Everyone's a creator, but everyone's also receiving something from another. So you get your bees, they pollinate your fruit trees, and you get honey, and they receive the pollen from the flowers. So they're producing honey, you take a little bit of their honey, they flower or they pollinate all your fruit trees that help the apples grow, and you plant wildflowers to help feed them extra. You know, you're looking at how you can stack as many different natural sort of as many different factors in as you can and stack them so that there's no limit to your creativity. It's all about design. It's all about architecture. It's all about realizing that on paper, you have no limits as to where you want to go with it, but you're working with the limits of the land. So you look at the land and you look at how you can shift the land and how you can create microclimates. It's all about creativity, imagination, and researching and going deep into what things are. You know, like what is a rock? How can I use a rock? You know, is it thermal mass? Is it how is it interacting in this environment? And actually, yeah, maybe the best way to describe it is going deep into relationships between all living things and seemingly non-living things, and just seeing how they all interact and trying to create harmony and trying to create synergy and trying to create it so that we live in a, so that ultimately we are living in a world where we are in a web of life. We're in the ecosystem again. We haven't removed ourselves from this this life system that works so well. Instead, we've dived into it and we've separated it apart so that we can respect each individual component and put it back together again in creative ways, rather than just separating it all out and not putting it back together in creative ways. So permaculture is all about that. And it's got its roots in indigenous cultures as well. I know that the Maori of New Zealand have started to really step up and own the fact that those teachings that the permaculturists like David Holmgreen and the other guys that sort of pioneered it, they were just drawing upon wisdom that was present in many ancient indigenous cultures, because the cultures that knew how to live in harmony with the land, like the people that live in the jungle, I believe that they're actually tending jungle like a garden, even if it doesn't always look like it. They're intimately connected to all the different plants and animals, their relationship, their function. I mean, if you're hunting an animal, you're not just trying to wipe it out. It's your food source. So you're trying to understand its behavior, its movements, when to hunt it, when to leave it alone, so that both of you are thriving. So it's kind of looking at that and just getting expansive, just keep expanding from there and realizing relationships aren't necessarily having to be a source of conflict. They can be rewarding. And it's just applying that to nature and social conditions. So I looked at that in New Zealand in a place called Golden Bay, and like restaurants were like connected with local growers so that local food could be distributed to local restaurants, and they were working in harmony with each other. So rather than getting one big massive monoculture agricultural farm and having to use so much energy and so much petrol in order to grow one massive crop and then ship it out across the world, you've just got this local radius of food that's where things make sense to be local, they're made local. And if something makes sense to be global, it's made global. It's kind of like an all-inclusive paradigm. And so and the way it will look is just dependent on where you are. So in New Zealand, it looks one way, but in the UK, it will look quite different because relationships are different there. But maybe I could go deeper into my personal experience of it, but maybe that's enough for the general overview of it.
Oh, brother, you have such a beautiful way of explaining things and just such a beautiful way of explaining that concept. I can see how passionate you are and how important it is to you. And as you're talking, it kind of brought up like just how ludicrous the system that we're in is. You know, well, the permaculture, it logically makes so much sense. You know, is giving back, is this closed, not closed, but it's a self-sustaining cycle of giving and receiving, whereas the paradigm we're in, which is causing, creating a lot of damage in the environment, is just the principle of taking. And it's like, I think the more we can go in this direction, the more it's going to massively benefit us. And I think it's getting to this tipping point whereby we have to stop. We have to go in this direction because otherwise what's going to happen to the earth? So I think, you know, from how you're explaining, I really got this sense of like how kind of misguided we've become in the name of profit and greed, really. So,
yeah, that seems to be the only reason not to follow the system, not to follow the permaculture approach, or even just to glean from it its wisdom and to work with it. Why not? You know, why not use knowledge that's so powerful? And I mean, it seems to be widespread. Money, greed and for money, and that seems to be the seems to be it. And it's like, well, then, you know, why what's money mean to us? What does energy mean to us? And so we just come straight back to doing the inner work and like having a little bit of a reflection of what, you know, where we're being greedy in our life and where we're not stepping up to be role models and that, because trying to change the system, like trying to change what Bill Gates is doing, you know, like maybe that's not your maybe that's not your path to directly try and change what he's doing, because to believe that he's all powerful person that can influence everything is, you know, that doesn't make any sense. It's just one person. You know, that's not how the world works. There's not one big queen bee that just decides, oh no, I'm deciding that we're going to change everything now. It's like it's a collective agreement, and it's like questioning our agreements that we've made, the contracts we've signed, like internally and physically, you know, with the world and with our neighbours and with the local energy companies, and starting to look at where we can make small steps in all of those relationships that we've got, because all the relationships already exist. You know, it's just a lot of them are in conflict, or a lot of them are in denial, or a lot of them are superficial, or a lot of them are not being honest. So it's kind of looking at the fact that we are already empowered because we're already in the web of life. You can't actually really remove yourself from it. You're connected to so many people, the people who make your clothes, the people who grow your food, the people who deliver your posts, the people who made your electronics. So every decision that we make, if we're aware of the fact that we are in relationship to someone, in every sort of action that we take and decision that we're making on that kind of level, we can decide to be more aware of our impact that our actions and our choices are making on others. And even if we are in a global scale, if I just decide to buy a new iPhone every 3 weeks, respectful to the people you're in relationship to who are making that iPhone, or to the nature that's providing the resources to do that, you know. So I feel like the power is there in our decisions, and becoming aware of what impacts our decisions are making, and making small steps to bring harmony into those relationships, bring respect, and then even if it's uncomfortable at the beginning, it's never going to change from being uncomfortable until we start to prune away the things that are going moldy and the things that aren't working. You know, it only works for so long not to look at it until your whole life is diseased and your whole life is going moldy. So if you look at it now, you can make the best of it and chop away the bits that aren't working before it gets to your core and before you get organ failure.
Well, when you put it like that. Yeah, no, amen, brother. Completely down the line with what you're saying, everything. Yeah, very well put. That's quite a good lead into the last question. So Phoenix Vision is related to creating a transformative vision of health and well-being for the future. So my question is, what does transformation mean to you? And what would you like to transform in the future?
Transformation to me means being and allowing movement to happen. Transformation is a belief. There's a belief about what transformation is. And my belief is that transformation is in its own right something that happens when allowed to happen. And so, like, let's say I've got a pain in my body and I want it to transform. My belief is that things transform when given what they need and when allowed to transform. It's like process work. It's like just giving it the time and the space and the attention. Things want to move. Life wants to move. Movement and life and transformation. Transformation is a movement. Life is movement. So it's not something that you're not the one creating life. You're not the one that's like making life happen from source. You're the one that's interfacing with it. So when you can recognize that, you know, it's not your responsibility for things to transform. It's your responsibility to get out of the way and to learn and to observe and to participate from that place. So that's my version of transformation. And I would like to see, I would just like to see the transformation of, for people to be in relationship together in a transformative way, where we're not holding on to concepts within our own heads. We can get out of our own heads and be present with relationships with other people and groups of people, and be part of a larger movement, a larger transformative power, so that it's easier for us to surrender as individuals to being of service to something that is so clearly and so obviously more life affirmative than whatever we're involved with at moment, and learn how to collaborate and to move as a bigger unit, not to give away our sense of self, not like we're in this together bullshit that's going on with the masks, but more like recognizing life affirmative movements and joining together so that power can be unified in this collective way. But that's a dangerous statement to make, because it's also like kind of what's happening with, like, with, you know, people giving away their power. It's not about giving away your power. That's the old way. It's about giving your power to a source that affirms even more power to yourself. So you're growing in self-actualization, you're growing in self-empowerment, but it's also through service to regenerating the world, regenerating each other's emotional, mental, physical reality and creative ability, imagination, of any activity, any group, anything that's got that quality of turning something from an issue like an addiction, like the 12 steps groups, into something which creates freedom. So I think that's what I'd like to see, more transformation from limitation where there doesn't need to be limitation, into a place where it's freedom, where there does need to be freedom. And I think relationships and groups is where I'd like to see that the most.
Beautiful, man. Thank you so much. Mate, how can people find out more about you? Are you coaching at the moment?
No, I'm not. And I've got a website in the role of getting created. Apart from that, it's just Instagram, Edward Thompson, and I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram, and I will have a website coming up soon. And in springtime, I'm on Brian Rose's London Real Accelerator course. So I'll have some stuff coming up in next year, 2022. So I'll be more present on the in the sort of online community in that space, in that time.
Amazing. I look forward to it, because I can see you creating so many good things in the world, brother. Well, you already are creating so many good things in the world. So yeah, power to you, man. And thank you so much for taking the time to come on to the podcast. It's been really, I've really enjoyed the last hour and a half or so. We really went pretty deep with things, and thank you so much for your time, mate.
Oh, I've enjoyed it so much, Jess. Thanks for inviting me on. Yeah, and I look forward to doing it again.
Yeah, me too, mate. Me too. All right. Peace, brother. Thank you so much. And yeah, how do I stop recording? There it is. Okay, thanks.